Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Welcome to the Solar Storm. Tonight I have a returning guest with me, Sophia Smallstorm from sophiasmallstorm.com and avatarproducts.com. Tonight we will be getting into a contentious issue. We'll be talking about viruses and overall germ theory and how there might be some more to the issue than people might originally think. As I said, this is a contentious issue. And the information that is going to be presented is somewhat paradigm shifting. So take from it what you will. I think that this topic really needs some more investigation. So that's what we'll be doing here tonight. Sophia, welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Kyle, you're always welcome. I love being on your show and talking about these things. And that was a very good intro for you to warn people that this is contentious or controversial. You know, the spectrum of what is believed about viruses is it's pretty broad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, then this is something that we just take for granted growing up in our modern world. The whole basis of medicine is essentially germ theory. There are all these germs out there, they're invading bodies, and you need the doctors and the vaccines and all the rest, and all the expensive pharmaceuticals in order to fix these problems and get rid of the different germs. And this is what I thought was the case growing up, and I still have some doubts about the alternatives to germ theory, but your newsletter here, it definitely raised some good questions for me. And the newsletter I'm talking about is the October-November 2018 double newsletter. So this one was 12 pages long. I just reviewed it last night before going to bed to be prepared for this interview. And there's certainly a lot to go through here. And it's a lot of stuff that, well, people just don't think of. As I said, we kind of take this all for granted, but germ theory only came about in the mid-19th century, and it's really just accepted as fact now, although it still is classified as a theory. So, Sophia, what first got you into questioning the modern paradigm of germs and viruses?
Well, you know, it was a lot of reading that I did, and I've learned to question in general, and then I had a good friend, and she still is a very good friend, Jennifer Lake. She has the blog polioforever.wordpress.com, and I think also jenniferlake.wordpress.com. And her musings, our telephone discussions, I really learned a lot from her and from Dr. Nancy Banks, who wrote a fantastic book, AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire. I had telephone conversations with her as well. And I really believe people should all read that book, because that book will throw the whole HIV/AIDS thing out the window. The baby and the bathwater, by the way. We are living in an age of complete deception when it comes to what this thing is called a virus. And yet, my discoveries in researching this newsletter took me to an even farther point on the spectrum of what a virus might possibly be. And I left behind a lot of people who do question the viral theory of disease. They are somewhere in the middle area of that spectrum. I'm not, you know, here's the thing, Kyle. I don't have a PhD in biochemistry. I don't have an electron microscope. I don't have any qualifications, but I have a mind. And my mind started thinking, and I just was twiddling around on Wikipedia, and I know people don't trust that, but there was a little notation at the bottom of the page on tobacco mosaic virus that just blew me away. And I know Wikipedia didn't make this up. It's part of the history of viral exploration and so forth. And that has made me now understand viruses in a whole new light and how they do this thing called engineered viruses. So let's start somewhere at a comfortable beginning, Kyle, all right?
Sounds good.
What will that be?
Well, I'm not sure. Where can we comfortably start with this topic? I guess let's start with just the mainstream conception of what viruses are. I'm sure most people would probably agree on this, that viruses are, well, they're infectious agents. They're not technically alive. And what they do is they go in and infect cells and then cause them to basically go into self-destruct mode. Is that correct?
You could say that's correct, but let's start where I started in my newsletter, maybe, because that will make people sit up and blink a few times.
All right.
So I read in Nancy Banks' book, if you open the book, AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire, and you can buy it as an e-book as well. But the very beginning of the book has a couple of pages, a long list of conditions that would give you a positive HIV test result. And I read these things and I went, what? And here are some of them. I put them in my newsletter, just a few. So what? You go for an HIV test. This is how it's determined that you have the possibility of developing AIDS down the line, right? You have to have an HIV test, right? In the West, not in Africa, but I won't get into that right now. So HIV positivity can come from any of these things that I'm about to read off. Leprosy, tuberculosis, systemic lupus, kidney failure, flu, herpes simplex 1 and 2, upper respiratory tract infection, malaria, rheumatoid arthritis, tetanus vaccination, organ transplantation, various autoimmune diseases, hepatitis, alcoholic liver disease, multiple myeloma, hemophilia, hyperbilirubinemia, primary biliary cirrhosis. Okay, so there's a very long list. It's over a page long in book-type font. It's almost 2 pages or a page and a half. And I'm thinking, how is it possible that you can go into a clinic, have an HIV test, and you get a positive, but it could be from any of these things? So Dr. Banks explains that the HIV test is it's just a gross general antibody test. It is not a specific antibody test. It just tests for antibodies. So, and we have antibodies all the time that our body is making, right?
So a positive test just indicates a corrupted immune system, pretty much. Is that the case?
Not corrupted.
The immune system is
doing the right thing when it makes antibodies. It's making a protective agent for something that it considers foreign.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing, just to give you an idea, they put in vaccines in the 60s peanut oil as an adjuvant, an extender of the vaccine medium. And in America, tons of children have developed peanut allergies. I mean, you can't even be in an airplane. They don't give out peanuts anymore because the very microparticles of peanuts in the tight airplane cabin air would cause people to have anaphylaxis or whatever, eruption of allergy from the peanuts.
No one was allergic to peanuts when I was growing up. That was the safest thing you could have when you had to give lunches to all these different children, right? A peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It didn't even exist in my mind that people were allergic to peanuts. Now everybody is. It's crazy.
Right. And it's because, it's a little digression for our show, but when complete or half broken down proteins or oils are found in the bloodstream, you see, proteins, these complex molecules, proteins and oils, they normally enter your body by way of your mouth. They are part of the materials that end up in the bloodstream, lipids, amino acids. Those are the basic building blocks of proteins and sugars. All of that is disassembled in your gut because you take that stuff in when you eat. So if you actually have a puncture in your arm and somebody injects complex molecules like oils and proteins into your bloodstream, then those have not been disassembled by your gut, right? Because they didn't come in that way. So that's when you're Th2 immune system, that is the humoral or antibody-making immune system, goes nuts. And it says, wait a minute, my partner, the Th1 immune system, the cell-mediated immune system, which is the gut is part of that, digestion is a part of Th1 immunity. My partner, Th1, did not do his job. He has sent full complex molecules of proteins and oils to me. Now, I've got to go nuts here. I have to get into super motion. And so the Th2 immune system is over-triggered and it starts producing all kinds of antibodies because it's finding things that it shouldn't have in it. So this is why you get autoimmune issues as a consequence of being vaccinated. Your body makes antibodies to these proteins and oils, and peanut oil was one of the oils. Get it?
Mm-hmm. So the body's reacting to foreign agents, but those foreign agents are not viruses. It's what people are having injected by men in white coats, lab coats, into their bodies. Yeah, it's
right.
It's interesting.
So HIV, I learned from Dr. Banks, is a non-specific antibody test. If you go in and you have a positive, it means you have antibodies. Big deal. You're supposed to have antibodies. What kind of antibodies? The HIV test is not going to tell you. But they use this, if you don't mind my swearing, I'll use one little swear word.
Sure.
They use this as a mind fuck. They told people, oh my, you're HIV positive. Now this means you could very well develop full-blown AIDS in a matter of months or years. And the best thing you can do is be very, very careful, and you better get on our drug cocktails right away because we can do something to prevent this eventual outcome. And that alone sent people into a tizzy that they were HIV positive. Now, they always recommended, to cover their ass, that you should have another HIV test 6 months down the road. Well, guess why?
Well,
because you might not have the same antibodies.
Interesting. So do some people go from being HIV positive to then being negative and vice versa pretty quickly?
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
I'm telling you, this was a very big scam. So Nancy Banks' book is about the virus hunters. And let me give you a little bit of history around this germ theory idea. So it was Louis Pasteur, we've all heard of him, who really gave us this germ theory of disease. In spite of the fact that man had existed with microbes forever and that we have microbes inside us, thank you very much, that digest our food because we cannot do it by ourselves. We don't digest our food. Did you know that? We cook it, eat it, put it on the plate, marvel, love it. It tastes yummy. It feels great going down. We like the flavors. But once it lands in our intestinal tract, We don't know how to break it down. It's the bacteria in our gut that break the food down, and they separate it into sugars, polysaccharides, lipids. That's the component that makes up fats, and amino acids. Those are the components that make up proteins. And now we can actually do something with this. with these components. So our body has microbes in it. Always did, always will. We can't exist without them. And yet we were told that germs infect us and they make us sick. And we need to have a war against germs, germ warfare. And so not only did they send us running to the doctors in the white coats with their chemical drugs and so forth to battle our germ invasion when we got sick, so-called germ invasion, they sold us a bunch of chemical cleaners, Lysol, Clorox, spritz this, spray that, DDT, very big one back in the 50s. Mothers were actually sprinkling DDT from what looks like salt shakers, canisters with holes in them, onto their children's sandwiches for lunch.
Mm-hmm. And it does look like there are things that people want to avoid, to keep clean in order not to get sick. And one of the ways that a lot of people get sick is from foodborne illnesses. I don't know what exactly the mechanism is, but when you're dealing with people preparing chicken or any other kind of raw meat, but especially chicken in their kitchen, if they don't clean up properly, well, the people in that house might end up getting sick. I don't think that this itself was made up. It's just the mechanism that is in question here for me. But what do you think about such things as foodborne illnesses? What's happening there?
Kyle, I did a show with Sage of Quay, and I may have covered this with you a little bit, called Biological Darkness and the Sepsis Agenda. And when anything dies, it's now fodder, it's meat, it's giving out resonant frequencies to microbes, bacteria, fungal forms, even things like hawks and crows and vultures that descend on a carcass in the woods, a tree that falls down and is dying on the forest floor or is dead on the forest floor, starts to grow tremendous amounts of fungi, molds, and little beetles and borers come. And so these are the decomposers of the world, the detritivores, they're called, in the biological kingdom. And they hack up, chew up, put out enzymes to break all this material down and render it into nutrients for the trophic chain so that the producers, plants, can start using these nutrients and feed life forms above them and so forth and so forth. So when you have a dead animal on your cutting board, it is calling out to a bunch of microbes that are in the environment saying, eat me, eat me, eat me, I'm dead. And all these bacterial forms descend on that chicken that you're hacking up so you can make, you can deep fry it or whatever, or breadcrumb it. And those bacterial forms in large quantities will challenge your body. So everything has to be in the right quantity, right? The right balance. Mm-hmm. So that's where I believe foodborne illness comes from. Now, let me tell you something. This is another little aside, but I think listeners like these fascinating asides. I found out recently that urine is not a waste product. Does that surprise you? It surprised me.
Well, I know it can actually be used for fertilizer, to be honest. It has a good chemical makeup for what plants need, which is interesting, but you can't directly apply it. But anyway, yeah, please continue with what you're saying.
Urine is a blood product.
Huh.
It has got the same components as your blood. It's just a very diluted form of what's in your blood, and it's mixed with ammonia and water and stuff like that. But it's not a waste. Urine is sterile, just like blood. So what the kidneys do, they're very intelligent filtration machines. They receive the blood, fresh pumped blood. The kidneys get 25% of the freshly oxygenated blood from your heart. Kidneys are tucked in your core. They're high up, actually. They're not as low down as people think. And they filter the blood. They look at it. They have nephrons, millions of nephrons in each kidney. These nephrons are the little filtering mechanisms, and they're very smart. And they look at the blood and they go, too much of this, too much of that, too much of this, too much of that. And they pick out very specifically what exists in overabundance in the blood and they return the nutrients back to the blood that the body needs. And then what's picked out by the kidneys, selected out, is mixed with water and excreted. So why do bacteria come running at urine? Because it's a blood product. And then, you know, the biological kingdom gets very excited. So the urine signals, it's part of, you know, your blood that's now outside your body, and it draws bacteria. And that's why people think it's unclean and it's a waste, but it's not. So once again, your body is a very intelligent, very clean, self-filtering system. And this germ warfare, when they started putting these noxious chemical cleaners in our lives, guess what happened? People still got sick. They still got sick in spite of the war on germs. So they had to invent another villain. And they decided this was the virus. It was smaller than a bacteria form or a microbe. And it wasn't organic like bacteria or microbes, but it still was infectious and it could replicate and it could do all kinds of crazy things. It was very acrobatic and agile. And they started telling us that viruses were another giant gateway of disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and viruses carry RNA, correct? So it's not alive, but it has one strand of DNA in it. Well, the half of the strand, if I remember correctly. Honestly, I haven't looked into this in quite some time. But I know the little diagram that they have that looks almost like the lunar module that they faked the moon landing with, you know, little landing claws. And it looks like an alien invader, the way that they portray it. And viruses, people are taught to be scared of them from birth. And anything that can keep away the viruses is going to be a godsend, and we have to be worried about this new virus that is coming about, or that one. You know, SARS would be one example of how they scared a lot of people. And you've got the Zika virus in the news still. So viruses have been really a part of all children's indoctrination into how to remain healthy, is you got to avoid those viruses. So let's start getting into the nature of what viruses actually are. They didn't know about them, right, until they were able to start seeing them under, was it an electron microscope that was first needed for viruses to be seen?
To be seen in specificity, yeah, but okay. They did not know what they were looking at because, you know, Joe Imbriano, I did a show with him, and he made a very good analogy. So he said when he was a young kid and he used to ride his bike all over town, he had to avoid areas where there was broken glass, where there had been an accident, because broken glass would put a hole in his bike tire. So he would see broken glass and he would say, oh, there's been an accident here. I better not ride through this glass. But somebody else might conclude that broken glass was the cause of the accident, because everywhere there had been an accident, there was broken glass. And everywhere there was broken glass, there had been an accident. So a person who doesn't have experience might say, oh, this broken glass causes cars to crash. So which came first, the chicken or the egg? That's the question. So when they discovered or invented the electron microscope, they started seeing what they actually classified as fuzzy white blobs under this electron microscope. And they saw them in the tissues of people who had polio. And they said, my, my, this must be the cause of polio. When in fact, it could also be the result of polio, right?
Yeah.
And it was discovered that viruses were crystalline in their formation. And they were, in my interpretation, that means they're piezoelectric. If they have crystal form, anything with crystal form that's in the body has a role in the body's electrical life. So piezoelectricity, to remind the audience, is wireless energy produced by crystals. So the crystal is the medium. It's like a seesaw. So when you put voltage on a crystal, it will release a frequency, a pressure. It will tremble. When you put pressure on a crystal or a frequency on a crystal, it will release electricity, a voltage. So that's the way piezoelectricity works. And piezoelectricity works constantly throughout our body. It's the way our cells get electricity and make electricity. There are crystalline materials, structured electromagnetic crystalline materials. All in your DNA, there are crystalline proteins. In your cytoplasm of your cell, the surrounding watery part of the cell, that's all structured water. That's electromagnetically charged crystalline form water. You have crystals in your bones. You have crystalline materials, your muscles. Dr. Jerry Tennant, in all of his work on healing as voltage, you can look it up on YouTube, Tennant, T-E-N-N-A-N-T. He says that every time you get up and walk or move or exercise or stretch, what you're doing is you're shifting muscle tissues, you're compressing them, extending them, contracting them, and they are creating voltage. They're piezoelectric also. And that voltage is charging different organ systems. So this is why sitting still all day is so bad for you. Getting up and walking and moving charges various organ systems. The nearby muscles are battery packs for those organs. So we are electrical, but are we plugged in anywhere? No. So the body is making and using its own electricity, and it's doing that through its crystalline forms.
Very interesting. So these viruses that are found after a person gets sick, you're saying they're not causing the sickness. Perhaps they're actually there to heal the person from the sickness. Now, what about the argument that doctors are able to prescribe different antivirals that take out the virus and the person's able to start getting well again? What's taking place when people are supposedly getting healed by these doctors who are addressing the viral cause of the infection, as they put it?
I honestly don't know, Kyle, and I would not agree with the claim that people are healing from the antivirals that they're being given by Big Pharma. Mm-hmm. So let me take you to what I found on Wikipedia. There was a guy, in fact, he's one of the fathers of modern virology, or maybe the former field of virology, because modern virology is very, very different, very advanced now. So he was a Russian botanist, and his name was Dmitry Ivanovsky. This is 1892. And he was looking at tobacco mosaic virus, because this is actually a pretty generic disease. It doesn't just affect tobacco plants. It affects tomatoes and cucumbers and orchids. It's called spot disease. And when these plants have spot disease, they get withered leaves. It comes from basic stress, environmental stress. So they become, you know, infected, crinkly leaves, puckering. They have big dead areas on them. And tobacco mosaic virus was, so in 1903, Ivanovsky published a paper about these crystalline intracellular, he called them inclusions, that he had seen in tobacco plants that had spot disease. And he concluded, as anyone might, that this must be the infectious agent that caused the plants to have this disease. These crystal inclusions. That's his word, because he didn't know what else to call it. So he was able to transfer those crystal thingamabobs to healthy plants. And it worked. They grafted into the cells of healthy plants. And he thought, oh, this definitely has to be a disease agent. But I looked further down that page, on Wikipedia and I saw investigational uses of tobacco mosaic virus. And this is what I read. Due to its cylindrical shape, high aspect ratio, self-assembling nature, and ability to incorporate metal coatings into its shell, tobacco mosaic virus is an ideal candidate to be incorporated into battery electrodes. Addition of TMV, tobacco mosaic virus, to a battery electrode increases the reactive surface area by an order of magnitude, resulting in an increase in the battery's capacity by up to 6 times. And I'm reading this going, what? This virus thing can amplify a battery's capacity 6 times? It's got to be piezoelectric. And then it hit me. The body makes these crystalline materials as healing agents. When the cells are taxed, stressed, sick, and they're going, help me, something's happening. I need some solution. The body, the immune system is an intelligence network. It makes these crystalline forms that can get into the cells and teach the cells how to make more of this stuff. And they're piezoelectric because they increase the cell's electricity, and that's what it needs to heal. Because Dr. Tennant tells us in his talks that a cell needs a certain amount of voltage for upkeep and maintenance, and it needs more voltage when it's sick and dying so that it can heal. And that's when I realized, oh my gosh, I get it. Viruses are healing agents created by the body under stress, shipped to certain cells, carried by the bloodstream. They're found, they've been incorrectly identified, and they actually exist to heal us rather than to make us sick. And they're not out there lurking in ponds. There's no exogenous virus that is the cause of a deadly disease. In my humble opinion, there are only endogenous viruses. Exogenous means outside the body, endogenous inside the body. There are endogenous viruses that we make for our own healing purposes. And Kyle, the ones my body makes are meant for my body and myself. The ones your body makes are meant for your body and your cells. And we're not supposed to be putting them in vaccines. We're not supposed to be getting diseased tissue from, you know, people who have polio or whatever. This is how they made the polio virus. And putting monkey brains and rabbit blood and all this stuff that they were putting in vaccines, they're just putting debris in, transferring it between people's bodies, which causes massive antibody production by the Th2 immune system, and resulting illness.
Now, one of the questions I think a lot of people will have is how infectious diseases really work then. What's the mechanism? For example, we've all heard the stories about mothers would just have their children, when one had chickenpox, they'd put them all in a room, have a chickenpox party so that they all got the disease and then they wouldn't have to worry about it later. What would be causing the infection to spread if it's not a virus exiting the body of the infected child and then entering other children's bodies? How are they spreading these diseases then?
Well, let me say this. I have no degrees. I have only my mind and some common sense that it contains. So I spoke to a very famous anti-vaccine doctor, Dr. Tenpenny, once, Sherry Tenpenny. And I asked her, I said, well, where did all these diseases go? How come children, we don't hear about children getting chickenpox or measles or mumps? And she looked at me and she said, very candidly, she said, do the pediatricians even know how to diagnose these things? In most cases, these were very mild childhood diseases. And she said, wouldn't it be easy to tell a kid's mother that your kid has a rash instead of saying he has chicken pox, or your kid has swollen glands instead of saying, well, this is mumps. So that is one possibility of where the diseases went. And you asked how the infection occurs. I have had discussions with anti-vaccine researchers and formed the opinion, this is my opinion and some of their opinion as well, other people's, that these are rite of passage diseases in childhood and that they're actually cleansing mechanisms by the immune system. They're strategic, sometimes timed, meaning at certain ages you do this or that. I personally believe, Kyle, that there's no such thing as transmission of a cold by a virus, like the common cold. I believe that a cold, even a horrible cold, is about renewing layers of tissues in order to fortify the body for a time, which is usually the winter, when there's less sun, therefore you make less vitamin D, and nutrients are harder to come by. There are less the availability of photonic electrons, electrons from the ground, free electrons, it drops because you can't go outside barefoot when there's 2 feet of snow. I mean, you can, but you can't spend hours out there. So as the winter approaches, as fall approaches, and the sun starts to drop, you know, earlier, and we aren't getting as much vitamin D being produced, your body can say, you know what, it's time for me to rebuild all my tissues, all my respiratory cell layers, all my mucosal cell layers. I've got to start cleaning out and rebuilding. So seasonally, you will begin to feel crappy because your body's going through major overhaul. And then you'll start hacking and sneezing and blowing your nose. And this is all the shedding of layers of tissue. And it's actually specific. The color of, I'm sorry to be gross, but if you're hacking up green stuff, that's a certain cell layer. Pink stuff is a different cell layer. White stuff, yellow stuff, that's different cell layers. And your body goes through this rehab, this refurbishment seasonally. And if you take the big pharma's, you know, anti-cold medication stuff, then all you're doing is suppressing your hacking and sneezing and loosening of these materials that you've got to then replace. And you won't do it completely. So 3 weeks later, you'll quote-unquote catch another cold because you haven't finished doing the replacement, tissue replacement job. So why we get sick is a very interesting topic of discussion. And the chronic, you know, seasonal types of illnesses, I shouldn't say chronic, but seasonal. I mean, there are people who don't have a cold in 3 or 4 years, and it's because they did a damn good job replenishing tissues the time that they did it. And then when you are in proximity with someone who is hacking and sneezing and you get sick, it could be that your body gets a resonant signal from this person who's rebuilding, and your body says, it does a self-check, and it says, you know what, I think I need to do this too. This is a good idea. I don't know, but whether you are actually infected is a question to me. I think you have to do this periodically.
Mm. Well, Dr. Jim West argues that a lot of the common winter cold is actually due to people locking themselves up inside along with the same air. They're still using their heating equipment. They're still cooking with the stove, and there's a lot of toxicity going on. And it's all trapped inside, and that's what you're breathing over and over again. That could be one of the causes. And it seems to make some sense to me. It's still kind of a little bit of a mystery to me, and I don't exactly know, but I see what you're saying makes a good deal of sense as well, the body wanting to protect itself and to regenerate itself, and that requires you going through what is known as the cold. And it is very telling, though, that some people just seem to be sick so much more often than others, and it's the people who don't eat very well. It's the people who really don't take good care of their mind and body. So sickness is a big business, and a lot of people are sick. They're taking medications to try to stop being sick, but some people just seem to be perpetually sick. We do live in a sick society, but we also live in a very toxic one. So could we talk just a little bit about how the toxicity of the modern world. The poisonous nature of it could be what is mistaken for this, all these viral infections.
Well, definitely. That makes complete sense. I mean, we are in an environment that is full of chemicals, artificial man-made substances that our body is completely unused to and that are actually very hazardous and detrimental for our tissues. And people who are chronically sick could be sick for many, many reasons. They could have an autoimmune issue. You know, Dr. Zach Bush, who formulated the product Restore, and I would encourage people, if you've never tried Restore, you should definitely get some. And if you get it from avatarproducts.com, my online store, you can you will get a free pump. I recommend getting the 32-ounce bottle because it is a two-month supply. And 2 months on Restore could really change a lot of things in your body. So this is a product that we don't have to go into the discussion of what is Restore really. But, you know, there is so much that we are assaulted by, and Zach Bush, the originator of the product Restore, who was a medical doctor and was formulating chemotherapy drugs, that was his business. And then he completely left that arena and became this amazing, you know, bright light in the world of really healing people. He says there's only one disease. And you can call that different things, depending on where you want to go in the body to describe its origination. But there's only one disease. It's mitochondrial failure. Now, I said that we don't digest our food. The mitochondria in our cells derive from ancient bacteria. So we have a communication system. You could call it an ancient electrical language called redox signaling between the bacteria in our gut that work on our food and disassemble it, and the mitochondria in our cells. They are both from a foreign life kingdom to us. They are eukaryote. We are eukaryotes. They are prokaryotes. And they have been harnessed by the body to do certain kinds of work in the body. And this communication, this electrical communication between the bacteria in the gut and the bacterially derived mitochondria in the cells controls a good bit of our health. And so when the mitochondria start ailing and failing, they are little organelles, they're called, in the nucleus of the cell. And they are responsible for keeping the electric charge up in the cytoplasm of the cell. A conventional way of putting this is to say they create ATP. They reconstitute the ATP nanobattery in the cell, which is the cell's source of electricity. But the fact is, overall, the mitochondria are responsible for keeping the electrical charge correct in the cell. And that is the life basis and the work, the work energy source of the cell. So if the mitochondria start to die and malfunction, the cell doesn't make enough energy. And that becomes, quote unquote, disease in a particular type of tissue cluster or cell cluster or organ or whatever. So all disease originates from mitochondrial failure in a particular system or part of the body. And Dr. Bush maintains, as many others do now, that all disease originates around and in the gut, because that's where one half of the bacteria or one side of that electrical conversation occurs. The other side, the other half, is the mitochondria.
Very interesting. Could we get in now a little bit to cancer and what cancer is? It was thought to be actually a viral infection for quite some time. And I know you've done a decent amount of digging into the HeLa cells. So I think getting into this area could be productive for this investigation.
Right. So cancer, to put it very simply, is a cell. It starts with one cell that fails in its nucleus to produce or procure energy. And the mitochondria are basically defunct. So the cell has a fallback mechanism called glycolysis. And if it cannot make energy in the nucleus, that's called aerobic respiration, oxygen phosphorylation, lots of big words for it. It knows how to use sugars in the cytoplasm of the cell. It deploys enzymes and uses sugars, glucose, and it can create energy that way, but not for a very long time. So the glycolytic cell that isn't using its mitochondria for energy-making purposes anymore, because that's not possible. The mitochondria are dead or sick or dying. It starts to use glucose in the cytoplasm. And what a glycolytic cell might do is it might put a very thick protein shield around itself. This is a barrier. It's like a fortress wall. It doesn't want intrusion or invasion. And it's using sugar. And because the mitochondria aren't working anymore, it can't hear an internal signal to itself coming from the mitochondria called apoptosis. Apoptosis is regulated cell death, also called regulated cell division. It means that after 50 to 70 subdivisions, that's called the Hayflick limit, 50 to 70 subdivisions, because cells divide by making more of themselves. That cell gets a death signal. It goes, it hears this little bell ringing and it says, okay, I got to die. I did too many subdivisions. I'm over. But a cancer cell doesn't get that signal because the mitochondria are not giving it. So a cancer cell is like a psycho, crazy cell that does infinite replication, just keeps replicating and replicating and replicating and making more and more and more copies of itself. And that's a tumor. That's cancer.
Mm-hmm. And what part do the telomeres play in this?
Well, the telomeres are these parts of the cell that the older the cell gets, they get shorter and shorter and shorter. And there is an enzyme called telomerase. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. But that's the enzyme that allows it's a string of DNA, a telomere, to keep the cell going. So as the cell ages, the shorter the telomeres get, the more readily those cells will die. And I think you're getting into the subject of the HeLa cells, which was a very unusual type of cancer cell.
Mm-hmm. And real quickly, you think that it might have something to do with the radiation that was absorbed by tobacco plants, if I understood correctly. And I just find this fascinating because when I was thinking about viral infection and about radiation in general, I was thinking, well, you know, radiation poisoning is something that can actually be spread between people. If somebody has been poisoned with radiation, actually the whole trail that they've had, as we've seen with some spy cases, the trail that they've taken around the world is going to be partially radioactive. And so it just got me thinking that we really don't know necessarily how people always get sick. And it could be poisoning of some kind or another. And you pointed out in your newsletter that virus actually used to mean poison. And I just published an article on the Tribune called The Poisoners that people should check out. There's a long history of poisoning, intentional poisoning, but then there's also the unintentional poisoning that has taken place so many times over with lead pipes and things like that, or the use of mercury. It is really, really something to look into. Also, makeup for a long time was actually quite poisonous. And people don't know why they're getting sick, why they're acting erratically. Well, it's poison, and poison can be spread between people. So just wanted to bring that up, and you can respond to that, of course, and we can get back to the HeLa cells and why they were so big for the medical research world.
Kyle, again, I'm not degreed or anything, but I wouldn't call viruses poisons. I think that was an early definition,
right,
something that they were discovering, you know, in the body where there was disease.
Right. I don't mean the things that are identified now as viruses are poison, but the word virus once meant poison.
Yeah. I mean, we have the word virulent, V-I-R-U. That is quite, I haven't checked it in the dictionary etymologically, but that is possibly the same root for virus, V-I-R-U-S. Virulent means very harmful, very dangerous. So anyway, I did mention tobacco before when I talked about tobacco mosaic virus. The tobacco is a very, tobacco plant is very unique in many, many ways, and botanists have studied it for a long time. But there was a woman who lived in Virginia, and she was a sharecropper. Her name was Henrietta Lacks, and she was black and white. Her grandfather was a white man, a plantation slave owner. And Henrietta, in 1951, developed a cervical cancer tumor that was extremely, extremely aggressive. And she went to the doctor because she was bleeding, and she went to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, I think it was. And the doctor there saw this great colored purple thing on her cervix, and he took a slice of it. It was very, very easily agitated. It bled very easily, and he had never really seen a cervical cancer like that before, and he just had a desire to take a sliver of it, and it was sent to the laboratory of Dr. George Guy. He was the head of the tissue lab, and he and his lab techs, they received lots of different tissue specimens, and then they would try to culture them, because the idea then was, how can we grow human cells outside the body? So especially cancer cells, they wanted to see, to study. This was for study purposes. They wanted to grow cells in a petri dish and see if they could, and they hadn't been able to do that. So they cultured Henrietta's cells and named them, as they did with any tissue specimen from anybody at the time, H-E-L-A, because Henrietta, H-E with the first two letters of Henrietta, L-A-C-K-S was her last name, so Lacks, L-A-H-E-L-A. They became the HeLa sample. And normally, cells died in the lab. They couldn't get them to keep replicating. But the lab tech noticed that Henrietta's cells were just zooming away. They were just replicating like crazy. And she called the Dr. Guy and told him, these cells are growing like nothing I've ever seen before. They were actually doubling their numbers every 24 hours, accumulating literally by the millions. And this became the most popular cell line in biological research, biomedical research. It was the HeLa cell line. It was sold all over the world, air expressed. So the reason that researchers were interested in growing cancer cells was because there is a lot of similarity between the behavior of cancer cells and regular cells. So I'll just read from the book. There's a, by the way, if you want to learn about HeLa cells, there's a fantastic book to read. It's called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot, S-K-L-O-O-T. Very, very interesting book, very easy to read. It was actually a New York Times bestseller. So I'm quoting from the book.
Pretty good documentary that you shared from your website, too, that I reposted at the Tribune.
Oh, yeah, the documentary made about the Lacks family. Yes, it was very interesting. So despite being cancerous, HeLa cells still shared many basic characteristics with normal cells. They produced proteins and communicated with one another like normal cells. They divided and generated energy. They expressed genes and regulated them. And they were susceptible to infections, which made them an optimal tool for synthesizing and studying any number of things in culture, including bacteria, hormones, proteins, and especially viruses. There we are again. But so let me get into Henrietta's background. She grew up as a little child with brothers and sisters and cousins in the tobacco plantations. And these children ran around, played hide and seek among the tobacco plants, picked the tobacco. Often they dropped out of school or didn't go to school if there was tobacco to harvest. They would bundle and dry the tobacco and ride on the wagon sitting on the tobacco all the way to the big auction market, which was in a place called Boston, South Boston, Virginia. So they lived in the area of Roanoke, Virginia. So remember, and when you pick tobacco, there was a very oily resin that would stick to your fingers. And these are poor children. They're not washing their hands with soap every 5 minutes. So they had a lot of tobacco in their lives. They were eating, living, breathing, rolling in it, sitting on it. And tobacco is a phytoremediating plant. Tobacco will eradicate chemicals from the soil faster than most other plants. It was actually fertilized with uranium tailings from the Canonsburg Chemical Company in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That was the radium producing, that was the dream of America for radium production until they were beaten to the finish line by uranium from Africa. So tobacco is fertilized still with chemicals that contain the byproducts of uranium. Polonium-210 is one of them. And it is thought that that's the reason people get lung cancer from smoking tobacco, that there's tons of uranium byproducts in the fertilizer.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it was known that certain tobacco growing areas in the country received the tailings. Tailings means the byproducts of making radium from uranium. And there's a ton of waste. You know, you remember Marie Curie, right?
Correct.
Marie Curie was invited to America in 1921. She was the person who discovered radium in the late 1800s. And Marie Curie was given a gram of radium by the United States. And this gram was created at the Standard Chemical Company of Canonsburg, Pennsylvania. That was the real name of the company, Standard Chemical. And 1 gram of uranium at that time sold for $120,000 because of how hard it was to produce uranium. Radium, 500 tons of uranium ore would be required, 500 tons of chemicals, 10,000 tons of purified water, and 100 tons of coal to produce this tiny speck, 1 gram of radium. So there was tons of waste. Tons of waste. You can imagine the waste that would pile up just from 1 gram of radium. All this uranium, all this chemical stuff, water that was used, right? So what did they do? They trucked this to farmland, and tobacco would remediate. It would pull chemicals from soil, and that would make the crops grow lush because they were being insulted and injured. This is another theory of mine under the topic of chemical fertilizers. So it's very possible that Henrietta had a lot of radioactive material in her body. Henrietta was already having children when she was very young with her cousin, Day, whose real name was David. I mean, these were children living in little huts, unsupervised, and they were getting pregnant as soon as possible because they were messing around with each other. And Henrietta's cervical cancer could have been because she lived in contaminated tobacco. Who knows? But her cancer was extremely aggressive. And not only did it replicate like crazy, but it could travel. So I'm going to read from the book, Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It turned out that Henrietta's cells, now these are her cancer cells, okay, could float through the air on dust particles. They could travel from one culture to the next on unwashed hands or used pipettes. They could ride from lab to lab on researchers' coats and shoes or through ventilation systems. And they were strong. If just one HeLa cell landed in a culture dish, it took over, consuming all the nutrient media and filling all the space.
Now, I have to wonder, could these HeLa cells infect living people, or would they just be immediately destroyed as an invasion? Just wondering aloud here. I haven't seen anything about that, but since they're so powerful and they're being, you know, shipped all around the world, it seems like it could be a concern. If not in their current state, perhaps in a modified state, since they're doing so much research on them, perhaps it could be the ultimate bioweapon.
You know what, Kyle? There is the notion that the polio vaccine was deliberately laced with cancer virus. We've all heard this. And I happen to think that that comes from the fact that HeLa cells were the culture upon which they grew the stuff they call virus, which is really just, if you look into how vaccines are produced, it's just gunk and junk and fetid stuff. I mean, really gross tissue material. But HeLa could live on anything or even nothing. And HeLa cells reproduced like crazy. And this was the perfect medium to reproduce what they called poliovirus, which they were planning to inject in everyone. And one anti-vaccine researcher told me that HeLa cells are in every vaccine. Every vaccine in the world contains HeLa cells now, today. But the polio vaccine definitely had HeLa material in it because they were using the HeLa material to grow the cultures. So HeLa was a very, very, let's just say, you know, the Superman of cells and cancer cells and able to grow anything. The perfect base to grow anything you wanted to extend in culture. So yes, HeLa cells are in everybody's body. What they're doing, I don't know.
Wow, that is certainly a frightening thought. Well, Sophia, let's take a break here at the hour mark, and we'll come back and discuss much more on the other side.
Most of you are already aware that the sick freaks ruling our world are engaged in some of the most horrific crimes against children imaginable. This dark and depraved underground is something any healthy person would not even want to consider. But we must investigate their operations and expose these criminals to the light of day so that justice might be done. The recent Pizzagate revelations are just the tip of a massive iceberg. Watch The Big Picture, Pizzagate and Beyond. Learn the terrifying truth at beyondpizzagate.com.
Welcome back. I am joined here with Sophia Smallstorm, and her sites are sophiasmallstorm.com and also avatarproducts.com. Before the break, we were talking about the nature of viruses and about cancer cells, in particular the HeLa cells. Before we moved on to some new topics, I wanted to wrap up on two important examples that really just show how we don't understand the nature of infection, polio and AIDS. Now, first starting with polio, I'm pretty sure it was Dr. Jim West who said that that was actually caused by DDT and that we weren't actually, you know, cured by Dr. Jonas Salk from anything. It was just that they stopped spraying DDT. I don't know if that is the case, but I know in your newsletter, you mentioned that polio actually could still very well be around. It's just that it's not being diagnosed as such. So could you just elaborate a little bit on the whole polio scare and what you think of the nature of this disease?
Sure. Kyle, you know, first of all, we have to remember that the 1900s brought us the industrial age, the chemical age, and then also the radiation age, right? And remember that even though they fought the war on germs with all their chemical cleaners and everything, people still got sick. And it was discovered back in the 1800s, the late 1800s, that wherever they were using chemical pesticides on apple orchards, children were becoming paralyzed. This was called palsy, P-A-L-S-Y. And it was known that the introduction of chemicals as pesticides, treatments for growing food, were causing paralysis in children who are vulnerable, of course, because their immune systems are not well developed yet, in these areas. And this was the northeastern United States, if I'm remembering correctly. And the writer on this material is a Janine Roberts, J-A-N-I-N-E. You can Google her. Very interesting. The first connections being made to chemical poisoning, as you call it, and paralysis, polio. So polio is really an umbrella term for paralytic neurological destruction. And when they developed the polio vaccine, so to speak, the Sabin and Salk oral and injectable vaccines, they at the same time changed the requirement for the name, the diagnosis of paralytic polio. You had to have been paralyzed for 6 months in order for it to be said of you that you had paralytic polio. So naturally, the numbers of polio classifications fell dramatically, right? And this is how they were able to say that they eradicated polio. They simply changed the reporting statistic form. But polio is, again, neurological derailment, dysfunctionality, and debilitation. And I'll just tell you, it's pretty hilarious that the early symptoms of polio, we were told paralytic polio could show up in a very bland manner. I mean, you could have, you know, they call it actually non-paralytic polio, that you could have had polio and not even know it, because the symptoms were fever, sore throat, headache, vomiting, fatigue, back pain or back stiffness, neck pain or stiffness, arm or leg pain or stiffness, muscle weakness or tenderness. I mean, for God's sake, everybody I know and I will ever know has had those things. So have we had non-paralytic polio that we didn't know? This is the Mayo Clinic talking. So polio is a paralyzing nervous system disease. That's the official definition now, caused by a virus, and it's supposed to be highly contagious. But the fact is that in the 50s, they changed the threshold of how to report what was polio and what wasn't. And they introduced a whole bunch of new diseases thereafter, like encephalitis, meningitis, and now all of our autoimmune diseases and our sclerotic diseases, the musculoskeletal debilitation that we call Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, spina bifida, all this stuff, Kyle, is under the umbrella of polio. We still have polio, plenty of it.
What about Alzheimer's?
Alzheimer's, that's a neurological disease as well. Parkinson's. At one time, these would have all been called polio. But now we're told modern diseases, genetically caused.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Now, what about AIDS? This was such a scare in the world when I was growing up, and yet it never really amounted to anything amongst the general population. The big AIDS crisis that was taking place in, I think, essentially the early 80s was when it really was big. Well, it was amongst intravenous drug users and really exclusively male homosexuals. And the people thought this had to be the virus, or talking about HIV, but their immune systems were, it seems, reacting to foreign substances being introduced into the body and the body being abused in many ways. With the drug users, you might understand how someone that's using these kinds of drugs and sharing needles all the time might be getting sick by introducing foreign bacteria, foreign cells, blood cells into their body, and how this could cause a huge immune system reaction. The same thing could be said for the homosexual men. Now, I'm not going to get graphic about what anal intercourse has to deal with, but you're dealing with fecal matter, and you're also dealing with something that is not natural, lubricated, and has a lot of things associated with that are not good for one's health. Now, I mean, that's not coming from a biblical thing. It's coming from a biological perspective here. And what a lot of people, I don't think, understood at the time was the lifestyle that was being led by a lot of these party-going homosexuals of the 80s, where they'd have many, many sexual partners and also take a lot of different kinds of drugs, stay up all night. So they're not treating their bodies right. And then they get what is classified as AIDS. And I just, it's insane when you see that there are other logical explanations for why these people were sick other than the HIV virus.
Exactly, Kyle. You hit on a number of things that cause a tremendous amount of what's called oxidative stress. That means the cells are losing energy and not getting enough energy. And part of it, it's as simple as staying up all night doing poppers and these very, you know, taxing drugs. The nitrosamines in the systems of people who partied all night are tremendous, and they waste the body. And as you said, you know, the connection with multiple sexual partners, breaking tissues that are not meant to be, they're not elastic. Rectal tissues are not elastic in the way that vaginal tissues are. I also have a theory, and people can call me crazy, but I don't believe, Kyle, that we are designed to be around a lot of different people's microbiomes. So everybody has their own, just like everybody has their own genetics, everybody has their own biome in the body. Okay? So you have all different kinds of organisms living in you. They're on your skin, they're in your breath and hair and all this. And I do too, to say nothing of in your body, in your gut, and living in organs and everywhere. So we are intended to be around a limited number of different microbiomes. This is why we have the nuclear family and we lived in small villages. We're not supposed to be riding the subway with billions of people who have hung on to the straps and touched the poles and are breathing on us, living in these, you know, cities swarming with all kinds of creatures and chemicals and whatnot. We are supposed to have limited exposure to limited numbers of other people's microbiomes. And if we aren't, we get sick. A friend just came back from a cruise Christmas and New Year's, and he said, I've been hacking for 2 weeks. Everybody on the boat was sick. Everybody on the plane was sick. And I gave him my microbiome theory. I said, we're not supposed to be around that many people. And we get sick. We start spewing and hacking because our body is ridding itself of all of these foreign, I don't know what to call it. It's like a body print that's getting into us, you know, thumbprint, fingerprint, body print. But it's in the form of living material because you're host to God knows how many different specimens all living in a little country or culture, a big country or culture. That's you.
Now, do you think that viruses can be transferred between people? Let's say when I sneeze or something like that, when I cough, can viruses from me, although they could be doing a good thing for me, could they then get into somebody else potentially and then cause a similar thing to be happening within them? Is there perhaps some aspect of a viral infection within your point of view where viruses are not actually the cause of the disease, but rather an effect and also kind of like a cleanup crew. But could that possibly screw up somebody else's system? You talked about with the tobacco mosaic virus, how that was transferred to another plant. It seems like having somebody else's virus is within you, however they get there, if they're injected or they get there through the air, some kind of airborne virus, that it wouldn't necessarily be a good thing, even though your own viruses are good for you.
Once again, I would not use the word virus in this instance. I would use the word biome.
Okay. Yeah.
So you're being exposed. Okay, Kyle, let's get interesting and trippy here, all right? Why do people kiss? Why do people French and tongue kiss? You look at a second grader watching this and they'll go, ew! Why do people do that, Kyle? I thought about it a while back and I decided they're exchanging biomes. They're familiarizing themselves with the internal biome of another person because they intend to, on some subliminal level, be with one another, have babies, and live together. So this is how they acclimate themselves to the biome of another person.
Wow, it's kind of like a way of testing the waters in some sense for what would be perhaps inevitable if they are meant for each other, which would be the sexual reproduction of another child, where they are very much, you know, combining fluids and combining forces there in a very profound way. That's a very interesting way of looking at it, what kissing really is all about. And before that, what's the step before that? It's holding hands, which is another way to, you know, start to get the other person's so-called germs, you know, their biome, you know, integrated with one's own.
Right. And what precedes holding hands is closing physical space.
Right.
So in our culture, our society, we have a certain number of inches or feet that's considered proper to be away from someone. You don't want to, you know, be at a party and somebody comes right up to you, is right in your face chatting with you. You want them to keep their distance, 1.5, 2 feet, right? So the people who close physical space too closely is our children, because they're used to being with their mommy and daddy and their biome. So they think, oh, I'll be really close to this stranger. They won't mind because this is what I do. I'm happy and comfortable being close to the people I live with, physically close. So in courtship, this is my little yardstick of courtship. First, it's the eyes that inform. If you like what you see, you then speak. If you like what you hear from the other person that you're attracted to, you then approach and close physical space. So then you might hang out together, or you might actually, you know, be at the office together and they brush your arm with their arm or whatever. So these are just subliminal but strategic ways of closing space. And then you go on a date and you hold hands. So now you're really closing space, touching skin. Then you kiss and you exchange mouth biome, and then you copulate or whatever. Now you're engaging body biome, right? So this is it. Yeah.
Yeah, very fascinating. And the current way of the world, it doesn't really take this into account. Everything's supposed to be kind of so impersonal. They have all these different shows on, well, let's say Vice in particular. They had this segment that they would run. It's a very degenerate outlet, Vice. It's, of course, you by its name, you can tell it's about drugs and things like that. Where they had people meet for the first time and then hook up. And, you know, just setting people up like that, completely impersonal. It's, you know, they have this campaign to spread love, you know, in different places. The free hugs, you know, wearing a shirt, free hugs. And then they just go give people hugs, strangers. So they want for us to really embrace the stranger very literally, when that is not good for us. That is not the way we're meant to be. But, you know, this kind of just goes along with the whole AIDS thing that we were talking about before. Just think about how many, what having so many sexual partners could cause when you're dealing with sharing all these microbiomes in a very unnatural way. It's not good, and we're very far from that kind of natural way of being. I forget how many names it is that somebody is able to remember, or how much the natural, comfortable social network of a person is, but it couldn't be over 100 or so. And we have so many more than that. Even just the digital imprints we get from all, you know, people have thousands and thousands of friends on Facebook. It's so unnatural. Or even the colleges people go to. Very unnatural. Far more people than you're able to actually form a, you know, good bonds with, or, you know, to feel like you're part of an actual community. So, yeah, when people are taken out of their natural setting, their natural communities, they end up getting sick. And you see what happened with the conquistadors in the New World when they're bringing in their animals, their livestock that they've been become accustomed to over the years, what it did, the devastating effect it had upon the people who were living here and had not been introduced to that. So when people are advocating for, oh yeah, just open up the borders and let everybody from south of the border come on up, I mean, that's not only is that going to have devastating impacts on different things like the economy and just the way of life, the culture and demographics, I mean, that's going to have a big impact on, well, sickness in the country as well. That's just, you can think of foreign invasions on a small microscopic level, and then also on the macro as well.
Right, Kyle. You know, again, these are just conjectures on our part, but they're being made with a kind of, you know, open-mindedness. And again, what I go back to is cervical cancer, they say, is your risk of it rises with the number of sexual partners you've had. And seriously, that's introduction to a whole lot of biome. So if your poor cervix is introduced to sperm from, you know, dozens of men, then it's going to go, this is too much. I don't know how to handle all this information and all this exposure. And so it's going to start taxing the cells. This is the whole pap smear. And what's interesting about the book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, is that it keeps taking us to the conclusion that Henrietta's cervical cancer, never a mention about how she was rolling around in tobacco as a child, but it is from the human papilloma viral strain number 18. And therefore, we all must be vaccinated against HPV. This is where the book keeps going in its conclusion.
Well, and Gardasil has been so devastating. So not only girls now, but boys. Now they have boys on Gardasil because it's supposed to prevent rectal cancer for them. Oh, it's so awful seeing what's done to these young people. And with these women, the girls who grow up to become women, a lot of them end up infertile because they've been vaccinated against HPV a number of different times.
That's right. And, you know, it's worse than just infertility. It's paralysis. It's all different kinds of things that have happened as a consequence of the Gardasil vaccine. But I think you wanted to get into some of this tissue. We're talking about biome, and that is part of tissue discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And by tissue, I don't mean Kleenexes or used Kleenexes.
No, they're not going around stealing our Kleenexes to sample us.
No. Okay. But what's very interesting here is that people don't realize that their tissues are being saved by hospitals and clinics and labs. And I mean, every tissue sample, when a biopsy is taken from something on or in your body, that tissue is saved. And it's experimented with.
Yeah, the Lax family had no idea that Henrietta had her tissue taken and that it was now being used around the world. They don't need to tell anybody that what they're doing with it. They'll just go and do it. And perhaps he's kind of sign away the rights. And you don't think anything, you know, about it because, well, I don't need that. They took it out of me.
Exactly. You know, the Lax family is poor. And they have been unrecognized apart from being the descendants of Henrietta, the relatives and descendants. But Henrietta Lacks's cells have sold for up to $10,000 a vial. And there's a lot of money being made from that particular cell line. It is possibly the most popular cell line in biotech. Now, there was another cell line called Mo. Mo was from John Moore. He was a surveyor in Alaska, and he had hairy cell leukemia. This was in the 70s, and it filled his spleen to the point that his spleen weighed 22 pounds. And he was sent to UCLA because this was like too much for regular doctors. And the cancer researchers at UCLA removed his spleen, and then they wanted to monitor him every few months. So he was actually flown to UCLA on a regular basis, and he thought they were taking care of him, that they were being good to him, looking out for him, right? But he found out years later that they had been continually harvesting his blood and bone marrow as part of his, you know, post-treatment prognosis. And they had created this Dr. Gold, Dr. David Gold at UCLA, had filed for a patent on Moore's cells, which were called, the cell line was called Mo, M-O. And he had was making agreements with biotech companies that were giving him stocks and financing. And it was something like $3.5 million that he got to commercially develop and scientifically investigate the Mo cell line. So John Moore filed a lawsuit against this, and I don't believe he won. I don't believe he won that suit.
I'm pretty sure he didn't. And the court came out and said that it doesn't matter if something's, you know, actually living or came from a person. It's no longer part of that person, and then it's part of basically the, you know, it's the property, the intellectual property of somebody, the person who then later develops it for particular uses.
Right. And, you know, this whole world of patents on biological materials began, well, that case in the late 70s started it, the Moore case. But Ananda Chakrabarty was an evolutionary biologist, directed evolution at General Electric. He was a microbiologist. He was born in Calcutta, and he developed a better form of oil-eating bacteria. The oil-eating bacteria is called Pseudomonas putida, and they apparently exist, but Chakrabarty managed to genetically redesign this Pseudomonas putida and got it to eat 2/3 of the hydrocarbons in an oil spill, which is way more than the other kinds are eating, metabolizing. So he filed a patent on his form of Pseudomonas putida. And the patent office said, no, you can't do this. This is a living thing. You cannot have a patent on it. And this decision was made by Sidney Diamond, of the U.S. Commissioner of Patents and Trademarks at the time. This is 1980. And he filed a lawsuit, brought the lawsuit to the Supreme Court, because in the interim, having the USPO denying, U.S. Patent Office denying the patent, and then the United States Court of Patent Appeals said, no, 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 the fact that microorganisms are alive doesn't even matter. If you want to patent them, you can. So this provoked Sidney Diamond, the Commissioner of Patents, in 1980 to file a lawsuit against Dr. Chakrabarty. So that was the very famous, it went all the way to the Supreme Court, Diamond versus Chakrabarty. And the Supreme Court, the Appellate Court of California, they all ruled against Sidney Diamond. They all said that a live human-made microorganism is patentable. And if you use human ingenuity to alter a biological form, then it's not natural anymore and it can be patented. So this was what opened this world of patenting living things, Diamond versus Chakrabarty, the ruling on that case, 1980.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about where this could go. Patented living beings, designer babies, genetically altered humans. Of course, there's the Monsanto monstrosities, but it's very frightening when you think about the kind of biotech research that is being done. So when people send off their DNA samples to 23andMe, or when they go in and they have their surgeries, or even when some of these parents make a terrible decision and have their child's foreskin removed, you don't know what's going on with these tissues. They could be doing a lot of things with cells from people, and they don't really have to tell you what they're doing or how much money they're making from it.
Right. They save all of it. They save the foreskins. I mean, they put it in that cream, Velvelta. Yeah. Remember?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the skin cream. It was advertised by a number of Sandra Bullock, maybe, I forget all the celebrity names. I think Oprah was hawking it for a while. It's just so sickening to see what they're doing to human life, but all life in general. Now, what about the chemtrails? Let's get into this for just a little bit, because this is something that just really upsets me every single day. Almost, I either see the chemtrails actively being sprayed in the sky, or I'm seeing the results of it. It might be a clear day, but it's completely hazy. I'm never seeing the deep blue skies that I used to see as a child. And I never really thought of, well, them spraying anything that might be alive up in the sky. But this could very well be what they're doing, you know, along with some things like aluminum, strontium, barium that people have said are in the chemtrails. It seems like they could be putting out some bacteria up there as well, as you mentioned in the newsletter. And also, we have all these reports coming out from big mainstream publications that, oh yeah, thousands of different kinds of viruses and bacteria and all sorts of different things are raining down on us from space every day. Oh, they're coming from space, really, not from the planes spraying things around. But please do tell us about how bacteria actually would be the perfect agent for cloud seeding.
Kyle, I had heard that there were biologicals in chemtrails, of course, and one always connects this with the erythrocytes, the red blood cells that Clifford Carnicom discovered so many years ago that self-replicate. But, you know, if I read a term that I'm not familiar with online, I'll just Google it. So I was looking into this Pseudomonas putida, this multiplasmid that degenerates hydrocarbons that Chakrabarty was fooling around with. And I found out that Pseudomonas bacteria, that's a class of bacteria, and they occur in water and in plant seeds. They were first classified back in Dmitry Ivanovsky's time, 1894, and they're considered very metabolically diverse. They're able to colonize in a wide range of environments, and they have thereby become an excellent focus for scientific research. So Pseudomonas, I found out, you can read this on Wikipedia, may be the most common nucleator of ice crystals in clouds, thereby being of utmost importance to the formation of snow and rain around the world. So there was this Scientific American article from February 2008, and it said, microorganisms, particularly bacteria, produce proteins in their cells. I think it's called INA protein. In their cell walls that bind water, even if they are dead. In fact, they bind water in such an orderly fashion that water droplets freezing around a microbe almost mirror the natural lattice formation of ice. As a result, bacteria can help form snow at warmer temperatures than would otherwise be the case, which explains why some ski resorts add dead microbes to the mix in their snowmaking machines. And now, scientists have discovered such biological precipitation catalysts in natural snow in such regions as Montana and Antarctica. So the Pseudomonas that makes INA protein and allows water vapor to form, to cool and make rain precipitation is called Pseudomonas syringae, S-Y-R-I-N-G-A-E. And that doesn't really mean syringe. It means something different. But anyway, it's part of a botanical term. So from the internet, I read, looking up this Pseudomonas syringae, scientists are now wondering if there might be an entire ecosystem of rain-making bacteria living and reproducing up in the stratosphere. And, you know, to stick this stuff into chemtrails, forming material would be a no-brainer. So there you go.
Yeah. It. What kind of effect would this have on us, being sprayed with this? Do you know?
Well, once again, it's a natural way to make rain using materials that are biological and that reproduce the way bacteria reproduce. And if they're using it in snowmaking machines and the atmospheric scientists are all excited about it, then they're naturally, they have to be, for a long time, they have to be putting this in chemtrails. This is just my thinking. Yeah. This is, to me, common sense.
Yeah, and what do chemtrails inherently do? Well, it blocks out the sun, doesn't it? And as you mentioned, when you're not getting enough sunlight in the winter, you're not producing much vitamin D. And without vitamin D, your immune system is not going to be working at anywhere near optimal health, and you can end up getting sick. It looks like vitamin D, getting the proper amount of sunlight, especially not just supplementation, but sunlight to get good vitamin D into your body is one of the best things that you can do to avoid being sick and also to avoid getting cancer as well. Vitamin D is very crucial, and it's not even a vitamin, but anyway, is there anything that you'd like to add on to that? And also just any other way that we could try to stay healthy when we're being bombarded with so much poison in many different ways?
Well, Kyle, I could add all kinds of bits and pieces to that. But I wanted to mention that I read, I think it was in a Dr. Mercola newsletter, that if you live north of Atlanta, Georgia, that latitude, you will not be able to make vitamin D naturally from sunlight between the months of November and February, and that you will be relying on your vitamin D stores. And by February, these have run out, which is why everybody in the north goes running off to the Caribbean and Puerto Rico and Florida for spring break, right?
Yeah.
Because they're desperate for vitamin D. They've got to have sun because there's the groundhog said, you know, we still have 6 weeks of winter. Groundhog Day. So that was very interesting to me, and that got me thinking, because I like to just think. I like to pause when I read something interesting or learn something. I just pause, and I take a walk, and I think. And I started thinking about food. And, you know, we have sources, dietary sources of vitamin D. And it dawned on me that these countries in Northern Europe, where there isn't much sunlight in the winter, they turn to dairy foods as sources of vitamin D. This is why Germany, Denmark, Finland, all these countries make so much rich food over the winter, lots of buttery sauces and tons of milk and cream and cheese, because they are supplementing their lack of naturally produced photonic generated vitamin D from sun. They are substituting for that the food source of vitamin D. And then it dawned on me that with pasteurization, you probably limit the effectiveness of dietary vitamin D from dairy that's pasteurized.
Right, because so, it's heated, as Louis Pasteur found out. Oh, there's all these tiny little harmful agents in milk, so we've got to heat it up really high and kill that all. Kill the milk so that will improve people's health. And you can just see the devastating effect that especially modern milk has on people. Oh, it's just, I don't think we're supposed to be naturally drinking the milk of a cow, but especially as adults. But it's just, it's something that went from perhaps not being so bad and useful for people in the northern clime to be able to get that vitamin D, to being something that's very detrimental with no real benefit to it when you're not getting what you know our ancestors might have gotten out of it.
Right. Well, you asked me what can we do to improve our health. And, you know, I always tell people the simplest things, start have a few in your arsenal, iodine, magnesium. I sell these on my store, Avatar Products, in different forms. They're relatively inexpensive. A tube of magnesium cream is only $10. Takes away joint pain, supplements your body with magnesium. And just the provision of something like iodine and magnesium on a regular basis in your body. You can use the magnesium gel as a deodorant. It's a wonderful antimicrobial, but the point being that your sweat attracts bacteria, because any of these body fluids do. And so it's the bacteria in your armpits that start to produce underarm odor that in our culture we regard as offensive. So if you want to get natural deodorant, use a little magnesium gel, smear it under your arms, and you will have magnesium being provided to your body, and you'll have the deodorant effect on the biome that develops in the armpit. So that those two things, the product Restore, someday, I think we did a show on Restore, did we not, Kyle?
We did. We definitely did. We did a show on all of your different products, actually. We ran through almost all of them. I still take Iodorol, which is a high level of iodine in each one of the tablets. And I've found that it actually just provides the body with, I'm not going to say energy, but your body feels more energetic having that iodine within the system. It allows for the cells to all function properly. And I actually don't want to take it too close to bed. I usually take it in the morning because I've noticed before if I take it right before bed or something, I just can't really fall asleep. I feel a little bit too energized. So taking a high level of iodine has benefited me, and I really am glad that I found out about it, because it's one of those things that we're never taught about as children, that we should get enough magnesium or iodine, and yet they're so crucial to our health.
Yeah. You know, Kyle, Iodorol is a high-dose iodine in tablet form. It was developed by Dr. Guy Abraham, who was the guy who really, the doctor who, he was a medical doctor, he's dead now, who really blew open the iodine suppression that medicine had created, that Big Pharma had created, that the AMA had created on this incredibly vital supplement. So I don't recommend people taking Iodorol right away. You have to acclimate your body to iodine, and liquid iodine is a very good way of doing that. And you can start with a drop a day. So I do provide a dosage guide that is very conservative and cautious for people who buy iodine, and I sell three different kinds of iodine, and they're very inexpensive. There's a 1 ounce nascent iodine for $20, which is a great price on the website. So that, the product Restore, we can do a discussion on Restore again if you want down the road, or there's lots of things. I'm bringing in a few new things that aren't on the site yet, but maybe by the time this show airs, who knows. And one of the things I want to recommend, and it's free, you do not have to buy it, is tilting your bed. And I would say to people, if you want to improve your health and you don't want to spend a dime, just tilt your bed.
Sinead's doing this now. She really likes it, hasn't gone back. So thanks to you for that. But please explain to people why they might want to tilt their beds.
Well, the gift to us of the tilted bed idea is Andrew Fletcher, who is a British engineer, and you can check his website, inclinedbedtherapy.com. And he had been visiting the tombs of the pharaohs. This is probably, I don't know, a decade ago. And he noticed a strange thing, that the pharaohs' beds in these tombs were all elevated. They were slanted, tilted, and the head end was up 15 centimeters. And that equates to 5, 6, 7 inches in our measurement. And he started studying why they might be doing this. He figured they're on to something. What is it? So he studied the hydrology of trees, the water sap exchange, and found some very interesting things, almost a form of hydraulics going on. And then he studied the human circulatory system and found similar things. And he decided that, you know, it might be very beneficial to sleep tilted. Now, I am not talking about jacking up the mattress, half of it, so you're sitting in bed. Not that. And in fact, a lot of people will pile pillows or try to half sit, because that is a compensatory thing that we do when we're presented with this convention of sleeping flat. We don't like to sleep flat. We actually like to sleep with our heads higher than our bodies. But the best way to do it is literally to put some books or wood blocks, or there are bed risers you can buy, under the 2 feet of your bed that are at the end where your head is. And you want to lift the bed 5 minimum, 7 maximum inches. And you're sleeping on a slant. Your whole body is slanted. And this, you would not believe how much this improves circulation, because the blood is circulating. It's not pooling in your abdominal region and your butt and your thighs as it does if you're on a flat bed. It's actually flowing better. So you'll wake up with warm feet. You'll wake up with amazing energy and tingling, and you'll feel great. It gives you a profundity of sleep and dreams that you don't normally have sleeping flat. As you lie on this slant, the downforce, let's call it, the gravitational pull, we would call it otherwise, gives you a kind of gentle traction all night. So back pain, musculoskeletal misalignments, all kinds of little aches and pains that don't resolve when you sleep flat, will resolve much more easily when you're sleeping at a tilt like this. I mean, it is said to have cured within 2 or 3 days something like sleep apnea. My friend had that. He was cured of his sleep apnea, which had been a lifetime problem. And then, you know, there are things like varicose veins. It greatly helps varicose vein conditions. Someone just emailed me. She said she tilted her bed at my suggestion, and now her varicose veins don't hurt so much. So these kinds of things, migraine headaches, it's supposed to help, heart conditions, all kinds of circulatory problems, energy, sleep, quality of sleep. You don't get up to pee during the night because your renal arteries aren't sitting there surrounded by pooling blood that they have to filter. The blood is going past them to the toes. And so literally you do not have to get up in the night and pee as much. Or at all.
Very interesting. And it's just so telling that we use pillows. People want to at the very least, have their head, which is perhaps the most important, tilted. That's why they use a pillow. They have their head at an incline. Why not the rest of the body?
It's pretty, yeah, that's a good point. Pretty. So that's, you know, that's the most generous thing I can give you. It's free. Just do it.
Well, thank you so much for offering that advice about the tilted bed. I hope some people can try that out and have some good results. And I really want to thank you, Sophia, for coming by today and having this discussion with me here about this very important topic that, as I said at the beginning, a lot of people just take for granted. And I think looking into germ theory and viruses is a very important endeavor when we're trying to figure out how to really improve our health. We've been under this current medical system for so very long, and they claim to be able to offer us so many great things about modern medicine and take away all of our diseases, and yet look at how sick people are still getting all of the time with the heart disease and the obesity and all of the different related conditions where people and cancers. It's just absolutely devastating to see. And we need to really question the very fundamentals of our modern medical establishment to get to the heart of the issue and find out how to actually be healthy. So again, Sophia, thank you so much. And any final thoughts you'd like to offer for the audience?
Only I would press and insist that you try to tilt your bed. I've had so many friends who put this off, complaining that they couldn't find anything. And finally, a friend of mine who had a back pain issue, he used car batteries from his garage draped with dish towels, and they were the perfect height. So you can be very, very creative and just do it. You know, if people who have their beds in a frame or a box, that's going to be harder. But people who have beds with little legs or feet, you can do that very easily, and definitely try it. I'm crazy about the tilted bed.
All right, great. Well, people, please check out SophiaSmallstrom.com and also AvatarProducts.com. And stay tuned. There'll be much more to come on Renegade Broadcasting. Take care, Sophia.
Thank you, Kyle. Thanks so much. And Sinead, too. Thank
Always
her.
Good talking to you.
This is an important message on behalf of the WHO, the World Health Organization. It has come to our attention that various neo-Nazi groups are trying to promote natural, healthy, alternative products to white people. The Rockefeller Foundation didn't spend billions of dollars in creating the synthetic and safe medical and pharmaceutical industries, so some far-right startup like heathenherbs.com, to name but one, can now destroy over 100 years of testing on humans and other animals. Your painful death today helps us treat black, brown, and yellow children tomorrow. Thank you.
So, what were these differences? First of all, Pasteur stated that diseases arise from outside the body, while Beecham said they come from inside the body. Then Pasteur claimed that microorganisms are the primary cause of disease. However, Beecham said that the deterioration of the host body caused disease. And then Pasteur announced that every disease is associated with a particular microorganism, while Beecham countered that every disease is associated with a particular condition within the body. And finally, Pasteur proved that to prevent disease, we have to build defenses, while Beecham proved that to prevent disease, we have to build the body. So who was right? Let's first look to modern science. One school of thought says most disease is caused by germs or some form of static disease-causing microbe, also known as the germ theory. In order to get well, you should kill the germs, kill the microbes, kill whatever is making you sick. Drugs, antibiotics, chemotherapy, radiation, or surgery are the methods. The other school of thought says most disease is caused by some unbalance in the body. The unbalance occurs in some nutritional, electrical, structural, toxicological, or biological equation. In order to get well, you need to reestablish balance in your body by working with your body, not against it. If the germ theory were 100% correct, then why, when we constantly breathe in 14,000 germs per hour, are we not always sick? Have you ever wondered, if germs were the only answer to all sicknesses, then why do only a few people get sick in an exposed group while others are not affected at all, even if they drank and ate the same food, breathed the same air, or touched the same things? Beecham's "treat the patient, not the infection" stated that it is a mistake to try to kill the infection directly rather than to search for the cause as to why that person's immune system did not handle the infection on its own. The theory is that disease, or an unbalance in the body, causes germs. If we simply restore balance, removing the conditions upon which germs thrive, we can conquer disease. Eastern and natural medicine rely heavily on his work. Surprisingly, on his deathbed, Pasteur claimed that Beecham was right. So who got it right?
Hello everyone, Dr. John Bartimus here of Accelerate Chiropractic to talk about this week's topic for Accelerate Thinking, which is looking at the germ theory and is it a valid way to live our lives. Now, the germ theory states that the cause of sickness and disease are germs. And if this is true, then we need to be wary of germs and wash our hands and practice hygiene that will prevent germs from spreading and making us sick. So if I were to cough in my hand and go touch a door handle, and you had to go over and open that door after I had touched it, it may cross your mind that you're kind of paranoid to touch it because you don't want my germs. And immediately after you open the door, you'd run in the bathroom and wash your hands to get the germs off to prevent, theoretically, getting sick. My question to you is, have you ever been exposed to germs that your husband or children have been exposed to and you got sick but they didn't? Think about that. Why did you get sick and they didn't? If the germ theory is true, all of you should have got sick because you were all exposed to the same germs. Think about that. That's almost like the germ theory is almost is treating germs the same way that the genetics theory treats genetics. But in reality, if the genetics theory was true, everyone with the breast cancer gene would get breast cancer. We don't see that. If the germ theory was true, everyone who is exposed to a certain germ would get the sickness that that germ creates. We don't see that either. So the germ theory of disease and the genetics theory of disease are not true. The genetics theory is true for 2.5% of diseases, but 97.5% of disease is not due to genetics. The germ theory is false, as I've shown with just a couple simple analogies here. And even the man who created the germ theory, Louis Pasteur, on his deathbed, even said that the germ theory was false. What he said was, Beauchamp was right. Beauchamp was Antoine Beauchamp, his contemporary and his competitor, who at the same time that Pasteur was promoting the germ theory, Beauchamp was promoting the terrain theory. And what the terrain theory said was, your health depends on your terrain, or the inner environment of your body. The healthier that your terrain was, the healthier you were. If you had unhealthy terrain or an unhealthy environment inside your body, you were sick or got sick more often. And this is what we're finding and what research is finding more and more every day. It's the environment and what we're exposed to and our lifestyle choices that have a direct influence on our inner environments that determine our health and our sickness. So I'm here today to tell you that the germ theory is false. And although there are germs that cause disease, those germs cause disease in a body that has a sick terrain already. All right. So if you want to be as healthy as possible and live as long as possible, make the daily lifestyle choices that align you with the terrain theory and having a healthy terrain. And those choices are made in how your nervous system functions, how you eat, how you move, how you think, and what environmental toxins you're exposed to on a daily basis. I'm Dr. John Bartimus, and I'm here to help you create and maintain a healthy terrain and a healthy life. Have a great day.